It's time for Sounding Off with Phil Goff.
The Mayor of Auckland, Phil Goff. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mikey.
Thanks for joining us again here on BFM Breakfast. What's been number one on your agenda this week?
Oh, we've got our annual budget before council.
You've got a budget as well.
Right? Yep. We've got a budget as well. We do it a bit differently from central government. We set it out 6 months in advance. We give people the chance to be consulted. We distribute it to every household in the Auckland area. I think we had about 8,000 responses from members of the general public. We then meet with particular groups. And then tomorrow we vote on it. So that will have things like whether we can constrain our rates to 2.5% increase this year after some fairly hefty rate increases in recent years, whether we introduce a living wage for our lowest paid council staff, whether we share the cost of tourist promotion for the benefit of specific businesses in the city with those businesses themselves, whether we share the cost or put more of the cost on new housing developments on the developer and the people moving into it rather than that being subsidised by ratepayers across the city. Those are the sort of issues. What we do to help homelessness. We've got a fund there to coordinate a general response to the increasing number of people who are sleeping rough in our community. So all of those things are on the agenda tomorrow.
Is there sort of like light at the end of the tunnel for, we were talking about Rob, my friend Rob Bollocks, who came in, my manservant that came in this morning. He walked through Albert Park and said there's he walked past evidence of someone having to cook a meal like there on an open fire in Albert Park, which is not ideal. This is not the city we want to be living in. How do you stem the flow of homeless people, and then where do you put those that are homeless, and is it a matter of just housing them and keeping them off the street, or is it a matter of actually sort of going back and seeing what's the problem, folks? How did it happen? Does anyone goes and asks that question?
No, they are important questions, and there's two components to it. One, we're still not building enough houses to meet the growth of people in this city. And as demand grows higher than supply, rental costs go up, the cost of buying a home goes up, and more people at the bottom of the heap just fall over the edge. So some of the homelessness is not the visible stuff that we see around the city. It's people doubled up in homes, people sleeping in their cars in some of the outlying parks around the city and using the public facilities in those parks. But another component of it is those people who are sleeping rough, and this is probably the most pronounced end of homelessness, the people that you see out on the streets huddled in sleeping bags or with blankets over them in shop doorways at night. And that's often a more complex thing. It's one, yes, it's caused by the cost of housing, but two, it often involves personal problems on the part of the people who are sleeping rough. So,
because you can't just sort of go move along.
No. You've got to address the causes. So, what are some of those problems? Well, a high percentage of people have mental illness. A pretty high percentage of people too, I suspect, have addiction problems, alcohol or drugs. Some of them are out there because of relationship breakups. So, what do we do? Well, we're trying to tackle, first of all, the most severe end of homelessness, which is the people sleeping rough. And we're working as a council with five major housing providers, NGOs, and we're working with government. And we're following a principle called Housing First. That is, if you want to solve the problems that often lead to homelessness, such as mental illness or addiction, the first thing you've got to do is get a person in a house so that they're not out in the street, because you can't solve their problem while they're on the street. And secondly, you've then got to have the wraparound services that actually address the things that led them to be homeless in the first place. So that's called Housing First, and we've embarked on that policy in conjunction with government. We're aiming.
I was going to say the line's blurred there as to who, like when. who takes over when, I guess, doesn't it?
How much of it's
the council's responsibility, and how much should be the government responsibility?
Well, most of the resources, of course, to deal with this lie with government, both in terms of providing housing and in terms of the social welfare supports that exist to support people and the services that the mentally ill and the addicted need. So they are central government functions, but the problem is happening on our streets. So we're working, trying to work in a coherent relationship with central government, with all of their agencies, police, social welfare, housing, district health boards, and the NGOs, and hopefully we can bring the private sector in as well. So our plans at the moment, we've got about $3 million in funding coming from central government to pilot this Housing First scheme. What we're trying to do with the NGOs to directly providing the assistance, to probably try to house 400 to 500 people over the next 3 years that are in that situation. Now, this isn't an untested principle. In Hamilton, they've got what's called the People's Project. They've been working that for a couple of years. And, you know, they've found that a year after they've housed people that have been sleeping rough, 93% of them are still in the houses that have been provided, and they're getting the services they need to deal with their problems. And that's an international, that's pretty much the international experience as well. So we've got a well-proven model.
Those are pretty good figures. Those are pretty good figures.
Yeah, they're good. So I suppose our difficulty, Mikey, is that, you know, we're starting to do something about that, but, you know, with the pressure that's coming on and the growth in the city, are we providing the solutions fast enough to meet the growth and the problems that we're trying to deal with? And, that's the worry that I have. I think if we can prove that this works, then we've got a good case for getting the government to invest a whole lot more money in this, and the council will be playing the coordinating role. We're putting money up to coordinate the NGOs, the government agencies, and to try to get a coherent response to a problem that's just got worse and worse over time.
So we see maybe something in your budget for about that. There was an article saying that the council's bloated and you need to trim the fat in this budget. So, I mean, what is that true? Do you agree with that statement, or do you think it's more a matter of perception?
Well, it's a bit of both. Look, we've always got to find value for money in what we're doing. We've always got to try to find savings. We've always got to try to do more with less. But if I look at the figures and what the growth in council spending has been, actually the core operational spending, you know, that's been occurring in the city has only been increasing by 1.1%, which is probably just a bit less than the rate of inflation at the moment. The big expenditure areas are in funding depreciation and funding interest rates. And the reason for that is because each year we're investing billions more into the assets that this growing city needs, and that means that we've got a high level of debt to pay for infrastructure, because that's how you pay for infrastructure, and you've got to pay for the depreciation at the same time. So those figures are publicly available, so you can see where the increase in spending is coming. You know, in this new budget, we're going to have a couple of hundred million extra going directly into capital funding of infrastructure. We're trying to pay off the CRL. That's, we're putting $1.7 billion into that. So there are big costs, but, you know, do I want value for money and everything that the council does? Of course I do. And do councillors need to keep pressure on council to do that? The answer is, of course, yes. If you look at the staffing of council, in terms of the growth of the city, 45,000 extra people a year, the per capita staffing to head of, you know, per head of population, that ratio is going down. So we have less people per the size of our population than we did before, and we've probably got a better track record in keeping our costs down than most other local governments around New Zealand.
Last week, you and I talked about the government's budget and whether it was going to have any sweeteners for Auckland, whether it was going to treat Auckland in the way it needed to be treated, you know, give some, you know, afforded it the respect it deserved in the budget. Did you get what you wanted from that? Did Aucklanders, did we receive any sort of anything to help us along the way, or were we sort of pushed to the back?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is no. There's a lot of talk about putting more money into infrastructure, and I see the government...
That must be frustrating when the short answer is no.
What's really frustrating is that the government is calculating that it will have a $7.2 billion surplus in 4 years' time. Now, you know, there's lots of things that government can rightly spend money on, and some of the things that they were spending money on in the budget, they were fine. But infrastructure is critically important because, you know, let me give you an example, Mikey. They put more money into accommodation supplements. Now, you know, in one sense, I really welcome that because the people at the bottom of the heap trying to pay rents in Auckland, they're being absolutely screwed. They can barely afford to raise their family and pay for the rent. So the first adjustment in 10 years to the accommodation supplement, well overdue, that will provide some welcome relief. Now, the problems with it, on the other hand, so that's the good side of it. On the other side of it, the problem is, when they get more money, the landlord probably is going to raise the rent to take into account the fact that they're getting more money. But we're treating the symptom. We're not addressing the cause. The cause is not enough houses, too much demand, and that's forcing prices up. So we can spend $2.4 billion on accommodation supplements, and that price will keep on going up. But we're not solving the problem unless we can get more houses built. So that's why I said to government, put the money into infrastructure so we can get more houses built, put more money into roading and public transport infrastructure so we stop wasting $2 to $3 billion every year on lost productivity, and then you're attacking the causes and not just treating the symptoms.
Sure, sure.
But we didn't see enough of tackling the causes in this budget, in my view.
Sure. All right, I've got two more things I want to talk to you about. Somebody had a caller last week, say, ask the mayor, what's up with St. James? What's happening with the St. James? It looks awful.
Yeah, well, there was big plans for the St. James.
That beautiful theatre. The ravages of time.
Yeah, lovely part of our heritage and culture. And there was a deal, and council was putting tens of millions of dollars into it, you know, and your hand shakes when you do that. But it was reliant on a private sector development that was going to build above the theatre an apartment block. Now, those plans have crashed.
Scuttled.
So the money has gone into the earthquake strengthening and the demolition of the old Odeon and, you know, were pretty
the side
pretty
theatres,
scungy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the side theatres were pretty scungy. But that thing is on hold. We've still kept our commitment there to come to the party, but we're really short of funds. And we can't lift our component of the money to save the St. James, so we're looking to see what comes out of a renewal of plans to get development on the adjacent site and above the theatre that will help pay for the preservation of the theatre, and I really hope that that can happen.
Right on. So, and finally, you've scrapped the watercare plant in Oratia. Is that because Oratiotarians are just too full-on?
Well, they were a very well organised group.
I lived out there, a beautiful place. You don't want it out there. You don't want it out there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, the truth is they had a good case. The Watercare had two sites in Oratia and two sites in Titirangi. One on the existing site where the old and out-of-date water treatment plant is, and they said, look, we can't build on the existing site because that would take the water treatment plant out of commission.
Sure.
For 2 years. So that can't be done, and I accept that. They looked at Oratia and they said Oratia and Titirangi, the sites were pretty much the same. On the Titirangi site, this is a site adjacent to the existing water treatment plant, and it's got a designation over it for water care purposes, which has been there for decades.
Yep.
So you'd think that that's the place that they would have started looking at, but they said, well, we're required under law to look at options. They look at Oratia. They would have to have bought, I think, maybe 19, was it, private properties. They looked at the advantages and disadvantages of both, and their board made the decision, as is appropriate under the legislation, to build on the site that has long been designated for a water treatment plant. And that has some downside. They will try to preserve the trees that they can there, the best of the mature trees. It's a site that, as I understand it, was previously had houses on it for the Watercare staff, but there's since been regrowth. They don't need a resource consent for designation. They've got that, but they will need a resource consent to remove vegetation. So the local population will have a chance in Titirangi to make submissions on that. So there's a democratic process to go through. But the truth is, I live next door to a water treatment plant in Ardmore, have done for years and years. They're actually very good neighbours. But you've got to have the water treatment plant somewhere. Having clean and safe water is vitally important to us. That was no more emphasised than when we had the Hunua Dam. Suddenly the dam silted up with the rain. It's still cloudy. They're still not up to full capacity. We can't rely just on Ardmore. We've got to have alternative sites. We've always had a water treatment plant in the Waitakere's, and this plant is now designated for the site alongside where the existing plant is and the site that was designated for it. But they have to work through their consent process, which will be about how you best protect the trees that can be protected on that site and how that you replant in order that you're not taking out vegetation and not putting it back in. So there will be a debate, and I'm sure there'll be people in Titirangi that will be just as strongly opposed as the people in Oratia, but the water care people have followed the right process, they've reached their conclusion, and now it goes to the next step. They will need to seek consultation.
Right on. Good comprehensive answer there, Mr. Goff. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mikey. Hey, good to talk to you, mate. Have a great day.
Speak to you again this time next week. That's the Mayor of Auckland, Phil Goff. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
That was Sounding Off with Phil Goff.